This is the Gary Briley interview for April 4th, 2007.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Briley.
Yes.
This is Anthony Young calling. I'm a historian working on the history of the Rocketdyne F1 engine. And Martin Holman gave me your phone number. Actually gave me the number of several people I need to call, but he listed you as a retired Rocketdyne VP. And I was hoping to either speak with you today or maybe schedule a time where you could speak with me about your work at Rocketdyne.
Okay, you're talking about just the F1?
Well, primarily, yes, I am. I understand that you graduated from Iowa State in 54, is that right? Okay. If you're available to talk today, I just need about 20, maybe 30 minutes of your time.
That might work, be as good a time as any.
All right, great. When you graduated from Iowa State, were you hired directly on by Rocketdyne, or did you work someplace else first?
Directly.
Did you? Yes. I had spoken with some engineers who had recently graduated from college and were immediately hired by Rocketdyne during the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
So you started with Rocketdyne in 1954?
Yes.
Okay. What department do you remember first starting in?
It's called Applied Mechanics and Structural Analysis, Stress Analysis.
Okay. What engines were? Do you remember what engines you were involved with on that stint?
I guess you could name one.
Okay.
I worked on almost all of them.
Oh, did you? Okay. Was the Navajo engine work already in progress? Well, yes, it was already in progress, then, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. We were working on the Navajo at that time.
Okay. I was hoping you could help me. I'm gathering my Navajo engine information, and in fact came across a very good bit of information on it just recently. But the one engine that preceded the F1 that I'm having difficulty finding any information on is the E1.
The E1, yes, that was a... It seemed like it was 400,000 pound thrust somewhere.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. How did the E1 engine program come about?
You know, I'm not quite sure. It was an experimental program. I think it was an attempt to replace two barrels with one, I think.
I see, okay.
I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. And so you were involved with that program?
I worked on the turbo machinery.
Oh, the turbo pump?
Uh-huh.
Okay. That must have been shortly after. That was late 50s, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it had to have been late 50s, you know. It all kind of runs together. There were so many things going on at that time, you know, Thor, Jupiter, E1, H1, all that was.
Yes. What were your tasks in the late 50s, and were you in that same department?
Yes, I worked in applied mechanics, stress analysis, whatever structures, till about 1959, 1960.
Okay. And where did you, were you transferred to another department?
I spent a brief stint in solid propellants, and very brief, and then I went to what was called then space engines.
Okay.
And I was the supervisor in charge of the design development of the small attitude control engines for Gemini, Apollo, all those little small engines.
Oh, yes. I understand the The Atlas had quite a few of those too, didn't it? Control.
Well, the Atlas only had one small vernier engine.
Oh, really?
It was gimbaled engine.
Oh, I see. Okay.
In the space engines, we're talking about the attitude control engines of the capsules.
Okay. So, did you move from the Gemini to the Apollo capsule work?
Well, it was pretty much continuous, yeah. We worked on a bunch of other smaller stuff there, too. Advanced propellant engines and that sort of stuff.
Okay. Were you involved at all with the F-1 program?
Once again, I worked on the turbo machinery on the F-1.
Okay. Do you recall when you first, was there a dedicated department to the F-1, or were those engineers who had worked on turbopumps given the assignment as a group? You understand what I'm saying? I'm trying to understand the structure.
At that time, Rocketdyne was a functional organization. There was the program office,
mm-hmm.
and there was the project office, and then there was all the functions.
Okay.
Stress analysis, heat transfer, control, all of that was functional. And within each of the functions, there were people who were assigned to various aspects of different things. And you may have worked on several turbopumps or several controls or whatever, you know.
Okay. So what the turbo pump work that you did prior to F1, were you involved with the H1 then turbo pump project?
Well, the H1, the Atlas, the Thor, what became the Delta, and the Jupiter, and all that used all the same turbo pump, the Mark III.
Oh, I see, okay.
And that was a geared turbo pump with the turbine that drilled the gearbox through to the shafts. And, it was just different power levels, different mountings, different, they were different, but basically all the same pump.
I see, okay. But of course the F1 was just, I wouldn't say an order of magnitude, but perhaps it was different in terms of its size.
The other engines were 150,000 pound thrust each, and that was a million and a half.
So it was an order of magnitude. Do you remember? Yes. Well, initially it was, I think at the target was, they wanted to get 1,000,000 pounds at least off the injector plate and then go from there, build up on it.
What is your connection? What are you trying to accomplish here?
Okay. Let me tell you a little bit. I should have given you a bit more information on what I'm doing. I write aerospace history titles for a company called Springer Praxis. Springer is very famous for its scientific journals and scholarly textbooks. And Praxis specializes in aerospace history. And Springer and Praxis put out aerospace history titles. And my previous book for them was called Lunar and Planetary Rovers, The Wheels of Apollo and the Quest for Mars. And I interviewed a lot of the engineers and managers who were involved in the lunar rover program, as well as several who were involved with the Martian rover program, and then the Project Constellation, or at least Hope 4 missions that will include future rovers. And that was the subject of my previous book. And my for some time now.
Hang on just a second.
Okay.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can,
Yeah, well, I've changed the new phone system, and somehow I can't get the volume up so I can hear, and I have to go to the other phone.
Oh, okay, can you hear me okay now?
I can hear you very well.
Okay. So my second book for this publisher is on, it's titled Development of the Saturn V F1 Engine. It's not confined strictly to the F1 in terms, because it was really used in conjunction with the S1C first stage. So I really can't discuss the F1 without also including the S1C stage, because they were really a system.
The Saturn.
Yes. And
S1, Saturn 1, which is 8H1.
Correct, yes, that's right. I've always been baffled why no book has ever been written on this phenomenal engine.
The F1?
Yes, that's right.
That's the most phenomenal rocket engine ever built, I think, yes.
I am familiar with a book on Rocketdyne powering humans into space that was published a couple of years ago by the AIAA.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be getting a copy of that. But this is devoted to the development, testing, and management of the F1 program. And that's why I'm glad to be able to speak with you today, because finding Rocketdyne veterans who worked during the F1 program is getting increasingly difficult, as you can understand.
Yes, there's we're dropping by the wayside in groves, yes.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about when...
I was just digging in my files here.
Good.
I have there was a book that was published by Rocketdyne ever so often, not routinely published, but came out ever so often, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Threshold.
I've heard of that. Was it like a quarterly journal?
Well,
or what?
Like I said, it was ever so often.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It may have been quarterly. I don't know. In that is an article about the F1.
Oh, really?
Describes its development, why, what it was. It was a unique engine.
In every way.
Almost.
Mm-hmm.
It the only engine that ever had 100% reliability.
Isn't that something that's really astounding?
I mean, that doesn't count the development failures, but once it was, qualified and all that, that's what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a unique control system, a pressure ladder system.
Mm-hmm.
It started up, the gas generator started, and if there was pressure there, another valve opened. If that valve opened, there was pressure, then the next one opened, and it went right up the ladder to a full thrust.
I see.
It didn't depend on solenoids, all that sort of thing. It used the fuel, which was essentially it wasn't kerosene, but let's call it that for the moment, for all the hydraulics in the vehicle. And it
mm-hmm.
didn't have a separate hydraulic system. It used the fuel for that purpose. It was the simplest, most rugged one probably was ever built.
Okay. What was your first exposure to the F1 engine progress? How were you first informed, and what was planned for this engine? Do you remember?
Well, I was the lead engineer over the structural analysis of the turbopump.
Okay.
And we were also doing other pumps, doing other things at the same time, so to me it wasn't something that just here it is, here we go, sort of thing,
Mm-hmm.
It was one of many things happening.
Okay. Was the size daunting in terms of, because I've read that there were obviously studies done of this thing at Rocketdyne for the Air Force, I guess, initially.
Started with the Air Force, yes.
Mm-hmm.
NASA likes to claim to it, but it was an Air Force engine.
Yes.
In fact, most things were. NASA just sort of put their name on stuff.
Well, they did acquire the engine program in 1958. I guess the Air Force decided it did not want an engine of this size or need one?
Could be. On the day Kennedy gave his speech, going to the moon was the first full test of the F1.
Oh, I see. And was that out at Edwards?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me a bit then about what your analysis of the turbopump requirements for this engine.
Well, kind of hard to remember all.
Sure, of course. It's been 50 years, almost.
It was just bigger than the others. We ran tests of the pressure tests and of the castings for the pumps. We did vibrational analysis of the shaft, the size of the shaft. The turbine, as I remember, was some 65,000 horsepower, something like that. Oxidizer pump stage. Of course, they both had inducers, I believe, but I think it was pretty much the first one that had an inline pump. Turbine in line with the pumps.
I see. Okay.
I can't say that for sure, but it was one of the first that had that.
Were the liquid oxygen and the RP-1 intakes of the turbo pump, they were basically in parallel, correct? They the pump operated at the same speed for both LOX and RP-1.
That's right. They were an inline pump.
Okay.
Everything ran at the same speed. Turbine, both pumps.
Okay.
All run by one shaft.
Do you recall the first prototypes built and where they were tested for the turbo pumps?
Well, that would have been in Area 2 at what was then Santa Susana Field Laboratory, which doesn't exist anymore. I'm just digging through my thresholds here.
Okay.
Come up with the F1. I've got a whole bunch of these magazines. Here it is, I think.
Did you call?
Here's the F1.
Oh, good. I doubt I'd be able to find that thing. Would it be possible to get a copy of that article, or?
Well, I don't know what I can say about that. What we're getting into the company policy here. Bob Biggs was the guy that wrote the article.
Now, I've heard of him, but I don't know where I can reach him.
I'm not sure either.
Okay.
But this is an article describing the engine, kind of how it came about. Shows pictures of it, pictures of the internal parts. Shows the F1 at the Air Force Base.
Oh, really? Yes. What volume of threshold is that?
That is number 8, spring 1992.
Spring 1992. 1992. Volume 8. All right. Maybe I can locate this somehow. Because I know you probably don't want to part with it temporarily.
Not mine.
Sometimes I get people.
What was your name again, sir?
I'm sorry. My name again is Anthony Young, and I live in Miami, Florida.
Anthony.
Yes, Anthony.
Young.
Young. If you do a search on Amazon. .com, you'll see my name pop up there. If you type in Lunar Rovers, my book will come up there, and you can see a little bit about what that subject's all about. I almost wish I would have started this project maybe 20 years ago. But on the other hand, many materials and photographs that were taken during this program were not available then, Dave, because the internet virtually didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And the internet really makes it getting a lot of research papers, documents, reports that have been placed online makes my job a lot easier. But on the other hand, many of the people who worked on the program are not
with us anymore.
That's right. One of the engineers who worked at Marshall Space Flight Center, I spoke with his brother, Mr. Ballou. Leland Ballou was head of the Marshall's engine office. Well, he won't be speaking with me, and he can't speak with too many other people either, coherently, if you know what I mean. And that's unfortunate, because he was head of that thing for years and years. But
is it strokes or something?
His brother says dementia. I'm thinking Alzheimer's. Same thing that hit Bob Gilruth. And at any rate, I don't want to dwell on that, but...
You know this, during that stage of the game,
mm-hmm.
a little later, like Apollo 13 movie, for example, shows NASA doing all this and that and so forth. Like hell they did that. You know, that was done at the contractors, not in their offices.
Right.
And so, you know, they've rewritten the history to the point where they did everything. That's absolutely completely idiotic, you know, so...
Well, I've spoken with one of the Rocketdyne engineers, maybe you've heard of him, his name, Dan Brevik.
What was that?
Dan Brevik, B-R-E-V-I-K. He was involved with the thrust chamber portion of it, with a guy named Lou Bunoni, I think it is, and, he reported to Joe Erbs.
Joe Erbs, yes, I know him well.
I don't know if Joe Erbs is still with us, or where I can reach him. Are you familiar with where any other fellow F1 engineers?
No, I wouldn't know.
Okay.
I know some other rocket diners that I exchange emails with, but.
Okay.
Most of them were 5 to 10 years behind or ahead of me.
I see. Well, let's get back to the turbo pump work. What I'm familiar with the problems they had with the injector plate and the combustion instability, and I'm
That was called Project First.
Correct. Yes. Mm-hmm. Did you encounter similar development problems with the turbo pump? I guess any engine...
Turbo pump wasn't that big a problem, no.
Okay.
Once they got rid of that gearbox and went to the straight inline system, there were the normal things, of course, because in those days it was the biggest, fastest pump ever built and that sort of stuff, you know, but and you had your normal type problems, but they weren't big things like the Project First type thing, you know.
I see.
We weren't beating down big frontiers and that sort of thing like they were on the combustion stability, but...
Mm-hmm. Were the turbo pumps tested directly at Canoga Park, or did they have to go out to Santa Susana?
No, I went to Santa Susana. We didn't do any testing at Canoga Park.
Okay.
Had a vibrating machine, and we did some structural testing, but any hot fire testing was Santa Susana or at Edwards.
I see, okay.
I think Edwards is the only place that was big enough. We did test some workhorse stuff at Santa Susana. They call it the big uncooled combustor called King Kong.
Oh, okay. That's
just a big heavy metal combustor that they use to test injectors with. They only run short tests, of course, because it wasn't cool.
Yes, that's right. And how many You worked several years on the turbopump development then, right?
Yeah, pretty much through the, let's see, by 63, that part was pretty well put together.
Okay.
And at that point, they were just working on the engine stuff. I also went from there and I worked in,
well, there was a group called Combustion Devices, was that?
Yeah, but I went over and also worked on what they called the Lance engine system.
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, that was a storable system for the Army.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I was the engine project engineer on that program.
Okay.
And, so I had a period where I was away from that for a while, then I went back to it again.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, by the... a lot of flights before then, but the engine is qualified long before that, so the component work and the turbo machinery being one of those was pretty well squared away very early 60s.
Yes, I see. What was the first F1 with nozzle extension, I guess, test that you witnessed?
I don't know.
Oh, really?
It's very hard to recall those specifics.
Okay. Do you recall what the work schedule was like at that time? Was it...
Well, starting from the time I started up through the 60s until Nixon threw everything in a trash barrel.
Mm-hmm.
Up until that time, towards the end it wasn't, but we were working anywhere from 48 to 60 hours a week.
Yes.
That's what we got paid for. We worked a lot more than that, but that's what we got paid for.
I see.
That's what we were scheduled for.
I see. Okay. During that time, were you devoted... strictly to the F1 turbo pump, or were you working other programs as well?
No, I say I was in a functional division. I was doing a structural analysis of turbo pumps, of all of Rocketdyne's turbo pumps.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay, yes. All right. And so, how many years did you work at Rocketdyne then?
Well, I started in 54.
Okay.
I left in like 73, ran my own business, came back in 83, and left in 93.
Okay.
94, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any... I often ask, or occasionally ask this, because occasionally there are humorous moments in the midst of all this work. Do you recall anything, any humorous or particularly memorable about the program you were working on at the time? Because it...
Oh, golly, I guess I'd have to think about that.
I had written a history...
Engineering is 95% grind, and 5% panic, you know, so...
Yes.
It's mostly just head to the grindstone type thing.
Uh-huh. I imagine.
When you're working on brand new exotic stuff, it's still the same, you know.
Well, the 50s and the 60s were a very hectic period at Rocketdyne. I mean, they must have really staffed up there during that time.
That's right. There'll never be another time like that ever again.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I mean, it's... That kind of Apollo was like a once-in-a-century event.
Well, and all of the engine programs were. See, at that time, if you had a mishap, an engine blew up or something, the same tired old faces that show up in the middle of the night. We go through the failure. We go through the next day, have a meeting, decide what to do, and you had a plan in effect by the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And when NASA took over the stuff, then it took months to get a decision what you're going to do next, you know, and you had all kinds of inquisitions and blaming and finger pointing and all that stuff, you know. We didn't have any of that during the 50s, 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
We just want to get a job done.
That's what I've heard, and I've read of this NASA culture where I'm not sure how it came about, but it's really delayed progress on a lot of programs.
Well, it's quite simple.
Mm-hmm.
We worked with the Air Force for years and years, and I think about it now. A major or a general or whatever he is in charge of a program, how is he going to get promoted? He's going to get promoted if he does a good job.
Mm-hmm.
How does the guy from NASA, who's a civil servant, get promoted? If he builds a big organization, gets a whole bunch of people, and gets more money brought in, and like I say, makes his boss happy, who can hire more people, and it's a totally, totally different approach.
Mm-hmm.
The basic objective of a civil servant bureaucrat is not necessarily to get the job done. Yes, you want to do that, but first and foremost is themselves and their organization and expanding their influence.
Mm-hmm.
And the Air Force is not that way. Yes, there's some of that, but at the same time, the mission, that's the criteria.
Yes.
You carry out your mission, you get promoted. You don't, well, you're pushed aside.
Mm-hmm.
So, very simply, to me, it's that very difference in approach.
Okay.
Look how many things the Air Force has done over these years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic thing. How much has NASA done? They haven't developed a new engine since the SSME.
This is true.
Absolutely nothing. So,
for a quarter of a century.
That's right. And I blame that all on building bureaucracy instead of hardware.
Yeah.
The Air Force is, you know, God, the new airplanes and the new things they've got and the new things. Yeah, they spend lots of money and they've had the priorities, but at the same time, their focus is different. They want to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And their organization already exists, so, you know, that's not going to help them make it bigger.
Well, I think that the space shuttle is really a metaphor for NASA itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, look how long this thing's been flying. Why is that?
Yeah.
You know?
That's because, you know, they keep building an organization around it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if you go out and start up a new engine program and an engine blows up, oh my God, you got a congressional investigation.
Yes.
When we blew up an engine, there was about 20 guys that gathered around and solved the problem.
That's right. That's right. So you actually worked your way up to, I guess, VP at some point before retiring.
No, I wasn't VP. I was a director of advanced program.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I wouldn't want to be a VP. No way.
You like designing and building stuff as opposed to...
Yeah, that's too far away from real life. You know?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
I loved being the director because I had all kinds of really sharp people. All kinds of neat things, you know,
mm-hmm.
that were real. You know. You step up the other level while you're dealing with politicians.
Yes.
And that is not my thing.
Okay. I think I've really hit all these points here since you were confined to turbo pump.
I did work on other parts and other facets of it. Like I said, I worked on combustion devices, but of different engines.
Okay.
I did work on the Lance engine system, which was a complete system. And I did work in some project offices a couple of times. I covered almost all aspects of it, but early on, when the stuff was put together, so to speak. Yeah, I was in the structural department, and that was good because you got exposed to all facets of the operation, you know.
Okay.
Because everything had a failure somewhere that you had to go resolve.
Mm-hmm. When I wanted to cover, a point just occurred to me that I want to ask you about, because many rocket engines were designed with a given launch vehicle in mind.
Mm-hmm.
But the F-1, even when starting for the Air Force, the F-1 had no launch vehicle. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, yes. As far as I know, that's correct.
Okay. How did Rocketdyne deal with that, or did they have no problem with that?
Well, we didn't really, because our job was to build rocket engines.
Mm-hmm.
And the Air Force won the rocket engine, so fine, we'll build you a rocket engine, you know. So, and then, of course, you know, Kennedy was the one that essentially put it together, that the F-1 applied to that.
Yes. And everything followed, I guess, so.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, if they continued on with that type of Apollo program, now the SSME, I worked on that a lot, on the SSME. I was the project you see when the space shuttle takes off, those black cones that stick out the back?
Yes.
Three SSME engines?
Yes, that's right.
I was a project engineer developing those exhaust cones.
Okay.
So, and the SSME is quite an engine, and it's extremely, extremely reliable. It's the only reusable rocket engine in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's quite a step in itself. But had they continued with the Apollo program, see, the Apollo vehicle could put the whole space station into orbit in one flight.
I know. Yes, I know. Conrad Dannenberg told me the same thing. He said we could have put the thing up there in about two or three flights of a Saturn V or something.
That's right, exactly. No question about it. Probably more reliably.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you give me your email address so that I can contact you? And then if something comes up or you come across some material you think would be helpful to me,
thing would be this threshold.
Okay. And that's spring of 1992. Okay.
Spring of 1992, number 8, they call it.
Okay.
Yeah, my email address is George Lima Bravo, GLB.
GLB.
_
All right.
31.
31.
At pacbell.net. That's PACBELL.
PACBELL.net.
That's PAC, PAC, as in Paul.
Yes, PACBELL. .net.
Yeah.
Okay. GLB_31 at PACBELL.net.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's fascinating, but now that I'm. Excuse me.
Yes.
Last 4 or 5 years, I kind of turned to writing myself.
Oh, really? What are you working on?
Oh, I'm just working on this and that and the other thing. I've entered a few contests and won a few things, and I'm editor for the day in the local paper every so often. Nothing really spectacular. It's just writing is harder than rocket science.
I've been doing this for 30 years now, and it never gets any easier.
No, writing is very difficult.
And a lot of people you'll meet say, oh yeah, I've always wanted to work on a book or this or that, but they never step up to the plate and do it.
Right.
And because they've tried and it doesn't work for them or something, so.
Yeah, well, I'm beginning to, it's taking quite a bit of time. It's a totally different mindset.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm beginning to the point now where people are beginning to look at me and say, yeah, that's good stuff.
Okay. Well, I will...
Short stories, that sort of thing.
Yes, that's good. I like to think that every best-selling author at one point was doing something else before they took up writing.
Mm-hmm.
when you think about it, that's really true. And so it's possible for anyone to do it, but they just...
Well, to break into the publishing world nowadays, good Lord.
Oh, you know, I tried. For years I've operated without an agent, never needed one. And but for the Lunar Rover book, I felt, you know, maybe I should get an agent to try to help me with this. Well, you'd think I would never been, I'd published 8 books before. And I approached probably 50 literary agents, none of whom had the time of day for me.
Yeah.
And you'd think I'd never been published before.
Yeah.
And it's a, they're in the rejection business, and you have to wonder how they make a living.
We've got a writing group of what we call the cream of the crop of our other writing group, the 6 of us.
Okay.
We meet on Tuesdays.
Mm-hmm.
And we write and read and critique and all that sort of stuff, and talk about how to break through. Well, we've got 2 or 3 published authors in the group, and the same kind of story, you know, it's like throwing the chaff in the wind.
It's extremely frustrating, because you've got a good article or a book proposal, whatever, and it's like beating your head against the wall. It feels so good when you stop.
Yeah.
It is hard breaking in and getting published, but once you finally got an editor who likes your stuff, boy, you hang on to them for dear life. You know?
Yeah. But if you can find that or find an agent, finding an agent is probably as difficult as anything else.
Oh, you can find them. It's just getting one that's difficult.
The one that does the job.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Well, I wish you good fortune with your writing efforts there. And
I've got a couple of things coming along. Whether it ever comes to anything, who knows? But can always hope.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you talking with me today. And I will keep you posted on my progress. I'll fire off an email to you this weekend, so you've got my email address.
Yeah, I would appreciate that very much.
And I'll include a link to my the website for my book, so you have a little idea of what I've done. And
okay.
If something occurs to you, or you come across some information that you think I know about, just send an email off to me and let me know.
Yeah, I don't know whether I would be authorized to copy and send to you this article.
Okay, well, let me do this. First, I'll see if I can dig up a copy. I'm going up to the University of Alabama at Huntsville, as well as Marshall Space Flight Center, and they may have a copy in their file somewhere. So
they might. That's possible.
So I'll see.
Let's see here. Do I see a number? I think this is probably just the Rocketdyne publishing numbers.
Okay.
I don't see an ISBN on it.
Okay. Because normally they do with something like that, even assign ISBNs to journals like that. But okay, I'll in my search, if I come across a copy, I'll make sure to let you know so you can sleep at night.
I'd appreciate being kept on board what's happening.
Okay, I think you'll be rather pleased with this thing when it gets finished and it comes out. I'm going up to Huntsville this coming weekend. And I'll be meeting with Sonny Maria, who is the Marshall Space Flight F-1 engine manager, program manager, and several other people involved from the Marshall side, as well as going out to the university up there. They've got an excellent collection on Saturn V program that just goes for rows and rows. So I'll have my work cut out for me.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks so much for talking with me tonight.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.